How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Don McCune speaking. In the studio with me today is Bradford Washburn, the director of the Boston Museum of Science. By the way, the job that he works at 90% of the time, even though the Alaskans may be under the illusion that he's primarily a mountain climber. But Mr. Washburn has been in Alaska for a month now, doing work for the Office of Naval Research in collaboration with the Alaskan Air Command, and he's very kindly consented to come up to the KFAR studios and answer a multitudinous array of questions. Let's start off with Mr. Washburn. By the way, this isn't the first time you've faced a KFAR mic, is it?
No, I've been here quite a number of times. In fact, to be exact, I think this is my 18th trip to Fairbanks.
18th, and probably won't be your last, considering everything.
I certainly hope not.
Well, let's start off with this question here. What was the primary purpose of the 1947 Mount McKinley ascension?
When we were here 2 years ago, my wife and I and a party in all of 13 people, as you may know, we made the fourth ascent of McKinley. And I guess it was the first so-called scientific ascent of the mountain. We carried out quite lengthy observations on it, both mapping it, studying cosmic rays, making a large collection of geologic specimens for the Geological Survey. And I would guess that we probably chalked off the slowest ascent of Mount McKinley that will ever be made. We took 89 days doing it.
89 days going.
There were 89 days on the ice. But the purpose of this trip was a dual purpose, actually. We were making photographs of the ascent of McKinley for RKO Radio Pictures, who did the most important part of the trip from our standpoint, namely they paid the bill.
Oh, is that right?
Secondly, no museum of science would ever put an expedition onto McKinley simply to make a movie of it. And we had an agreement with RKO whereby if we assisted them in getting this picture, they would provide sufficient funds for us to take a scientific party on the mountain and do these other things. The reason that I'm here now is because of that expedition, even though it took place 2 years ago. Part of our work, as I mentioned a moment ago, was cosmic ray work. And we established a station at an altitude of around 18,000 feet, which the 10th Rescue Squadron of the Air Command dropped to us entirely. Nearly 2 tons of equipment were parachuted and free-fall dropped right into the notch that you see from Fairbanks lying between the two peaks of McKinley, a little over 18,000 feet high. And in the notch, during June 1947, we set up a cosmic ray station about which was very little was said at that time because nobody knew how it would work. And in this little insulated house, we carried out 10 consecutive days and nights of observations, which are the highest cosmic ray observations that have ever been made in a fixed position anywhere in the world.
I see. Well, the question rises in my mind, why Mount McKinley? Aren't there some other mountains, say, in South America or elsewhere that would be readily available by old donkey or something like that?
That's a very intelligent question. I think that's a question that 9 people in 10 would ask almost instantly. Actually, there are any number of mountains in Tibet, in West China, or in South America where you could drive up or ride up to 18,000 feet or more on a donkey. But the answer is just about as simple as the question. There are 2 important criteria for a place where it's good to study cosmic rays. One is altitude, because the Earth's atmosphere filters the rays out. It's rather interesting that energy, such as cosmic rays, can be filtered out by 18,000 or 20,000 feet of atmosphere until they're almost non-existent, comparatively speaking, at the ground, and yet they will pass through several inches of lead if you put it up in front of them at 18,000 feet.
Well, that's amazing.
It's really incredible. That is one. In other words, to get out of the atmosphere as high as you can. Secondly, and this very few people appreciate, then you want to be as near as possible to the North Magnetic Pole. And Mount McKinley, therefore, because it is very high and is relatively near the North Magnetic Pole, is the ideal place in the entire world for the study of cosmic rays.
Well, that answers my question completely. Well, I see what you mean by a simple answer to a simple question. Well, here's something else, too. We were speaking just a moment ago of this 1947 climb of Mount McKinley. What happened to the equipment?
But we left it up there. Actually, we left quite a large amount of fuel, and we left a considerable amount of camping equipment, and we left approximately 1,000 pounds of cosmic ray gear. And this stuff is right in Denali Pass now. You know, the notch between the two peaks of McKinley holds the original name of Mount McKinley, Denali, the great one or the high one, which used to be the name of the mountain itself before it was called McKinley, the Indian name. And we've got two caches in the pass, one on each side of it. One is a food and equipment cache, which in emergency anybody can go into, although that basically is the property of the Boston Museum of Science. And we don't want to encourage people to use it.
I see.
And secondly, on the other side of the pass, there's a special cache of nothing but scientific equipment. And they were very carefully placed. If you place them even a few feet on either side of the pass, they're instantly buried by blowing snow. And the collar of the pass is bedrock. And if you put them right out in the wind on the bedrock, they'll be windswept and absolutely usable at all times. The fellows from the University of Alaska who climbed McKinley last summer were able to get into one of our caches. They were running a little low on grub. They had bad weather up there, and we were very happy to hear that they'd opened our food cache, and they actually ate some of the frozen strawberries we'd left there 2 years before, still frozen up tight.
Well, that's extremely interesting. Well, being at that terrific, that very high altitude certainly must pose an indefinite number of problems. For instance, how long can you stay at that altitude?
Well, at high altitude, as you know, in an airplane, it's a very different situation from high altitude on the ground. If you fly above 12,000 feet in an airplane, particularly if you're a pilot, you are supposed to use oxygen, and it's mandatory above 15,000 feet. And on the other hand, bear in mind when you do that, you take off and you go up there in 10, 20, 30, 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're only up there a very short time. Climbing a big peak, particularly if you climb it slowly, your body adapts itself to the altitude as you go up. So when you get way up to 18,000, you're infinitely more able to resist the difficulties of living up there than you would down below if you came quickly up. So that some people acclimatize better than others. And we found that we were up there for, in all, 36 days at 18,000 feet without any oxygen at all. And we one of the things about the 1947 trip that was really gratifying was that we were able to carry out quite detailed observations for the physics department of the University of Chicago, for whom, who were doing all of this basic research for the Navy.
Mm-hmm. Just a moment ago, frozen strawberries, which brings us around to the very fine subject of food. What type of food and what sort of living conditions did you meet up with?
Well, that's a very big question. Both
well,
food and living conditions.
Let's boil it down to food, shall we?
Actually, with the food, I believe for a long time that one of the main reasons that people found it difficult at high altitude was that usually when you get to the high part of a climb, you've used up a large part of your good food, because the good food is usually the heavy food, fresh food. And you're living on dehydrated food and light food because you have to backpack it. Well, that whole picture changes when food can be brought to you. So we had fresh meat, fresh frozen vegetables, bird's eye fruit, and as a result of that, we had, in all, about 1,200 pounds of fresh stuff in Denali Pass. And although we had been told, and I knew from past experience, because we'd been on McKinley 2 years, 5 years before on the Army expedition with the other kind of food, to eat very much with dehydrated food, given fresh food and frozen food, you ate just as hard up there as you do down at sea level.
You found that true, then?
And I believe that the fresh food contributed enormously to our mental efficiency up there. And I know it contributed a great deal to our physical ability, and also, one thing you might not think about, and that's morale. It's good food and good morale go side by side.
Well, that's true. That sounds very logical. Well, it sounds as though the expedition ate very sumptuously, then, of frozen food and fresh food,
Well, we ate very, very well. And burning up the energy that you do working at that altitude, that's the very most important thing of all, is good food and good shelter.
Well, speaking about the shelter, let's go into this living condition problem that we mentioned a moment ago. What type of shelters did you use up there?
Well, we used several different shelters. Actually, the cosmic ray equipment was the best off.
How's that?
We had a little house for the Geiger counters and other cosmic ray gear and batteries.
What was the reason for that?
Well, that equipment, unlike us, couldn't go down to 20 below zero at night. And we had to keep the temperature up in the little cosmic ray shack so that it never fell below 50 degrees above Fahrenheit. And so the shack was a little 9x9 house about 7 feet high. And we pulled several parachutes over it. We pulled a tent over it to cut the wind. It was lined with this tinsel quilting, that stuff about 3 or 4 inches thick that you nail onto the inside. We banked snow 8 or 10 inches deep all over it from the outside. Of course, snow is a marvelous insulator.
Yes.
And during the 10 days that Victorine from the University of Chicago handled the observations, the mercury inside never fell below 50 degrees above.
A good job of insulation.
It was a darn good job. And to me, that was one of the toughest jobs that the outfit had up there, because that house was bombarded on the outside, with constant gales running from 60 to over 100 miles an hour. And the warmest night we had was 18 below zero. Oh. And most nights would go, the average night in June and July on McKinley runs around about 25 below.
How about the wind?
Well, the winds are terrific. 70, 80, 90, I'd say the average wind in Denali Pass is no less than 50 miles an hour. And then it gets
about
120 or so.
What is the reaction on a man at that altitude of those terrific winds and temperatures? They correspond any to sea level temperatures, or?
Actually, only in part. We've talked a good deal with old timers here about these temperatures. Now, actually, on the ground, a combination of 30 or 40 miles an hour with 20 or 40 below zero is perfectly passable. I've been out with dog teams in the western Yukon 15 years ago. We did a survey job there that required us to be 3 months out on the ice, and we constantly or very frequently ran into temperatures like that. I've seen it down at Tanacross where we had 40 miles of wind at 40 below. But McKinley is a very different proposition, because you've got to realize that up there you've left half of the Earth's oxygen supply below you. And your ability to absorb oxygen at that altitude is very, very low. So that you've not only got half as much oxygen to absorb, but your blood is not able to absorb very well what little oxygen there is.
Mm-hmm.
So that your ability to resist cold up there is no more than 50%, what it is down here. So I ask you to picture the average evening at Denali Pass with a 90-mile wind at 25 below, which would be equivalent in Fairbanks probably to about a 100-mile wind at 50 below zero.
At that rate, I'll ask you to change the picture. Getting personal for just a moment, what was your personal responsibility?
What was your personal responsibility in this, during this expedition?
You yourself.
So on our trip of 1947, my job as leader of the expedition was simply planning it and coordinating the work of the party so that when we finally reached the top, we were able to accomplish all our objectives. I actually did the survey work and the photography on the upper part of the mountain myself. Although we had two RKO radio cameramen who were doing the 35mm photography. I did the still and the color. And Hugo Victorine of the University of Chicago was in charge entirely of the cosmic ray work. And then we had other such very, very capable field men as Jim Gale of the 10th Rescue Squadron, who was my right-hand man in helping us put the job through.
Mm-hmm. Are you through with the expedition this last time?
Well, now, as a result of this trip in 1947, I was sent up here this year for a 3-week investigation by the Office of Naval Research. And I can't say much of anything about it at this very moment, because I'm on my way back to Boston, and I have to make a full report to them. On the other hand, I will say a few things about this trip right now, and if you keep this recording in your safe and don't release it until I tell you to, I think that we'll find that the ONR will permit me to say almost anything reasonable about it. The 947 expedition off of cosmic ray work was a great success. And as a result of it, the ONR and the University of Chicago are giving consideration to the possibility of putting a permanent research station at 18,000 feet on McKinley. Very, very important for me to say they are giving consideration to it.
I
Some
see.
People seem to think that we're going to build it up there. Actually, my job here was to, this summer, was to consider the whole situation very carefully. Both from the standpoint of the job of building a station up there and maintaining it, and getting scientific personnel who knew nothing about mountain climbing up to it. And I've got to make a full report to the ONR and University of Chicago when I get back, and then the final decision as to whether they will or won't build the station, which would be another year, will be made by them.
Mm-hmm. Well, those questions have been definitely answered in your mind as to getting the necessary personnel and equipment up to Mount McKinley. Is that right, to this last expedition?
Oh, yes. We've got very definite answers on them, and I don't think there's any question that if the United States government wishes to put a station up there, that it can be put up there and erected and operated. And if it did, it would be rather interesting, because it would be by far the highest research station of any sort anywhere in the world.
Well, now you're speaking of a highest research station leads me into this question. Why go to 18,000 feet on Mount McKinley when you can go to 40,000 feet in an airplane? Much easier.
Well, curiously enough, the answer to that one is rather easy, too. Nobody has yet devised an airplane or a balloon or a guided missile that will go up to even 18,000 feet and sit absolutely motionless for 10 days and 10 nights.
I see what you mean.
We've got in this same cosmic ray program, which Dr. Shine of the University of Chicago is in charge of, it's a basic research program in studying the upper atmosphere and the energy that comes through it from outer space. And they have B-29s going to great altitudes with this same equipment, and they have balloons, and they have it in these guided missiles that are going to tremendous altitudes. But none of them stay still. And there are certain questions that only can be answered by absolutely immobile observations. In other words, little variations between day and night, and little tiny variations from hour to hour or from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what this kind of a station can do.
In our preliminary discussion before we went off the air, Mr. Washburn, we discussed one piece of equipment, and I think we covered it lightly just a few moments ago. That was in regard to the instruments, particularly a Geiger counter. Could you elaborate that on that a little more and tell us just briefly what is the primary function of a Geiger counter on the top of Mount McKinley in relation to cosmic rays?
Of course, you've got to realize that my job here is a purely physical job. I've been asked by them to find out whether the station can be built, how much it will cost, and how hard a job it will be to get people up there. And I'm not a physicist. But I can say, as you know, that a Geiger counter is a very simple little instrument that will count the energy that enters it. And it can be aimed very accurately in any given direction so that it will count that energy. Cosmic rays coming into a Geiger counter at sea level under normal conditions will just make little ticks coming into the Geiger counter. They might sound something like this. You see, they don't come down at direct, at even intervals at all. Sometimes maybe three or four, sometimes one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And by directing a battery of six or seven Geiger counters and setting them up, you can not only count how many rays are coming in, but you can count almost exactly the direction in which they're arriving.
I see. Well, one more question here.
They're counted off on a Veeder counter, just like on a bike, just like a counter on your dashboard. You don't have to do any calculations. When they're down, there they are, right in numbers in front of you.
Just an obvious thing.
Yes.
Well, is anybody going to stay up there? For instance, this does go through, and the station is put up there on a permanent basis. Will any one person or a group of people stay up there over a great period of time, or how will they conduct that?
Of course, that would be a very interesting physiological question as to how long a group could stay up there and still keep operating with reasonably good mentality.
I see.
We've noticed in acclimatization previously, and the British have noticed it in India, in the Himalayas, in their attempts to climb Mount Everest, and of course they've gone a good deal higher than McKinley, is that you acclimatize very slowly, and you reach your peak in, say, 2 or 3 weeks at that altitude. And then you level off, and you're in pretty good fettle for a while, and then all of a sudden, you begin to go to pieces, and you drop very rapidly off. See, your body goes through some tremendous physical changes to adapt itself to the altitude. For example, your red blood count will probably increase from about 4 or 5 million to nearly 10 million at that altitude, because your red blood corpuscles help the body to absorb oxygen. And there's so very little oxygen up there that that's the body's mechanism for getting what little there is out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that strains the body a great deal, and it can just do that for so long. And that varies enormously between individuals. Some people go to pieces in 10 days. Some people never acclimatize properly. Others are in good shape after a month. It's our thought that we would probably have small groups go up there, possibly one or two scientists coupled with two or three or four very competent climbers would either come from the States or possibly from your university here, which has got a very fine growing group of climbers. And in handling that, that group would go up there and stay possibly 2, 3 weeks, maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks, depending on their physical ability. They would set a given series of observations up, and then after they'd got this observation well started, possibly, let's say, carrying them out for 10 days or 2 weeks, they could then leave the station with self-recording apparatus that might run for 30, 40, 50 days. And then another party would come up 2 or 3 months later and collect the data that had been left by that self-recording apparatus. Of course, once you've got a facility established, which is reasonably comfortable, reasonably warm and sheltered up there to work in. Three-quarters of the battle is won. The job is building that facility. That would take a whole expedition to do. Once that's set up, once your equipment is in there, a party can go up there and start work the day after it gets there. The way it is now, we'd have to go up there, if we were to do this, and maybe spend a whole month just building this little place. And the first experiment might be postponed for a whole year after that first attempt.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's come to my attention that two lesser peaks have been discovered up there, and I think perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit for us.
Well, of course, one of the key parts of this job that I've had during the last month up here was completing a very detailed survey of the immediate vicinity of McKinley, because Dr. Schein wants to have an altitude of the proposed location for this station extremely accurately. And we have set it as 18,180 feet, just about, as you can guess, just about 2,000 feet below the top of McKinley. And during the course of that survey, we turned up two very respectable and very beautiful peaks between Mount McKinley and Mount Foraker, which in the old days used to be called Denali's Wife, when McKinley was called Denali by the Indians. And one of these peaks is around 12,500 feet high, and the other is nearly 12,800 feet high.
Very respectable mountains.
Yes, they're very good-sized mountains, and the only reason that probably they hadn't been noticed or mapped in detail years before was the fact that they lie between two of Alaska's greatest peaks. Well, one of these peaks, the higher one, it seemed to me that it would be most appropriate to name after my good friend Joe Crossan, who has done so much in laying the firm foundation for scheduled air transportation around Alaska. And it has been my suggestion, and we are writing the Board on Geographic Names in Washington, suggesting that the higher of these two mountains be called Mount Crossan and that the great glacier that extends northward out of it into the plains, about 12 miles long, be called the Crossan Glacier.
I see. Well, I'm certain that the Alaskans would consider that a most worthy suggestion.
In the old days, McKinley had been flown over, I believe, just once. I've forgotten the name, I'm ashamed to say, of the fellow who made the first flight over it. But I think it had been done once or twice when a relatively wealthy fellow came into Fairbanks and asked Joe if he'd fly him over the mountain. And Joe told me this story himself. And he said, I had an airplane that wouldn't go over it, but it would go almost over it. So I told this fellow that I'd take him over for $500 if he wasn't in a big hurry. And the fellow agreed. And so Joe stood by for a few days until one of those days came with a big west wind. And it was really hiking it up from the west. And he took the fellow in this little open ship of his, and he flew him around on the northwest side of the mountain, and he just cruised back and forth there. And the airplane, with an altitude ceiling of only 18,000 feet, just got higher and higher up, and then he just turned around and floated right over the top on the wind and lost 5,000 feet on the other side. And Joe got his $500 and went back to Fairbanks.
The smart thinking on the part of Joe. Well, so far, Mr. Washburn, we've talked about generalities. Now, actually, what was your program this year?
Well, our program this year was very different from the one in 1947. This year, we are interested not in just climbing Mount McKinley or surveying it or photographing it. We have been trying to determine whether or not you could build a permanent research station up there. And if you could build it, whether you could get scientists up to it who were men who'd never had any experience in the mountains, because very few scientists who might want to go up there and use these facilities would ever have had extended climbing experience. So the work this year was very brief, just a month long, and it was a collaboration between the Office of Naval Research, which sent me up here, the Alaskan Air Command, which did all of our flying, the National Park Service, which provided us facilities in Mount McKinley National Park, and the Boston Museum of Science, which provided me.
I see.
Actually, the work boiled down to three very simple groupings. The first was survey work, which I've already described a little bit, because Dr. Shine of the University of Chicago, who is running this whole project, was particularly interested in getting the exact altitude of the location of our 1947 station, which would be the same position at which we would establish the new one. And we've boiled that down now to 18,180 feet, and we've done a very precise job on that. The second project was to make a detailed series of photographs of the way in which you get up Mount McKinley. As you know, there are thousands of pictures have been taken of McKinley from the air. But curiously enough, nobody had ever made an effort to make a sequence of pictures at relatively low altitudes above the ground. Of course, you get higher and higher, even though you're lower above the near the ground as you go higher on the mountain. And we made two photographic flights, one early in the morning, one quite late in the evening, to get different lighting on different sides of the mountain. And we've now taken a sequence of pictures so that anybody who wants to go up there, whether or not they've ever climbed McKinley, have not only got a very detailed map to work with that is accurate at last, but they've also got a fine series of pictures with which to find their way around on the ground. And of course, as you know, there's some big crevasses there that are always changing, and fresh, up-to-date pictures are very important. On those flights, we were flown for the Alaskan Air Command from Ladd Field by Captain Leonard Porter and Captain Carl Rabe. And they handled both of the flights, did a wonderful job for us with the C-47. They simply took the door off, you know, they tie you in so you can't fall out. And if the air is rough, and you just take them out that door, which is about the size of a barn door, as you know. Now, the last of our three projects, the first being survey work and the second photo flights, was possibly the most fascinating part of this job. And that was helicopter landings. Because I've always had the conviction, having been in over the lowlands between the end of the road and the bottom of McKinley 9 times now, that 50% of the energy that goes down the drain in climbing McKinley is wasted crossing the McKinley River waist deep or deeper in ice water. It's a very, very swift, rough river. Walking 20 miles through muskeg and swamp and then gravel valleys and then winding up with 4 or 5 miles of slush on the lower glacier.
It doesn't sound too appetizing.
It is not. To me, it's worse in many ways than the upper part of the mountain, particularly in May and June when you have those terrific hordes of bloodthirsty mosquitoes in the lowlands.
Ouch.
And that, unfortunately, is the best time to work on the upper part of the mountain. So we thought that it would be a wise move to study very carefully the possibility of using a helicopter to move scientific personnel over onto the mountain and land them around 6,000 feet and eliminate all that stuff.
Well, that's very interesting, this helicopter. Were there any unusual situations encountered in landing the personnel and the equipment by helicopter? You say you landed them at 6,000?
Yes.
And climbed the rest of the way.
Yes, well, of course, we didn't do any climbing this year at all. All we were interested in doing was in doing something that hadn't been done. And we know we can climb Mount McKinley.
Yes.
We know we can get to Denali Pass, and we know that we can get scientific personnel up there who've never climbed because we've done it. The one thing that we had not done, though, was to land a helicopter on the mountain. And at least in Alaska, there had been very, very few, even moderate altitude landings with helicopters. Nobody knew what it would do. So we discussed it with General Armstrong and his staff down in Alaskan Air Command headquarters in Anchorage, and they provided us with Lieutenant Bill Weed, who comes from Rifle, Colorado, and I would venture to say is probably the best helicopter pilot in Alaska now. He's a splendid pilot. And to my way of thinking, an extremely competent general operator in that kind of country. And we flew the helicopter into Wonder Lake and based it there for a week. And what we were trying to do, of course, was not to make a spectacular record. We wanted to set up a system of landings in there that might establish a record, but that would still be very definitely a routine operation. We made 6 landings on Muldrow Glacier.
6 landings. Well, that's extremely interesting.
They're by far the highest landings that have ever been done in Alaska. And in my opinion, and I know in Weed's, that they're nowhere near as high as you can do with that Sikorsky ship. We made one landing with no wind at all up there, just dead calm with a temperature of about nearly 80 degrees, right on the ice. And that is a density altitude of over 8,000 feet. So the air gets lighter when it gets warm. And if there's no wind, a helicopter always needs a little breeze to make it easier to take off. We had no wind at all. The next time we took Jim Gale of Anchorage from the search and rescue squadron, the 10th Rescue Squadron, 200 pounds of equipment, a big aerial camera, Bill Weed and me. So there were 3 men and 250 pounds of gear. We landed in there, we waited for several days, and we had 1.5 feet of fresh snow. We landed in that 6,000 feet and took right off without the slightest difficulty. And I'd venture to say that you could carry out easy operations up to over 7,000 feet. Cut the work of climbing the mountain right in half.
Well, that certainly would be a tremendous advance in eliminating all of that preliminary climbing up to that 6,000-foot level. And I think definitely you've established some remarkable feats, not only in landing the helicopter at that height, but also in proving that the elimination of the excess climbing can be possible.
Well, the thing that we are particularly interested in proving and in doing is to have this scientific job completely separate from an adventurous ascent of McKinley. Now, McKinley's been climbed 6 times, usually for the purposes of adventure. Now, this is not adventure. We're trying to do it as quickly and as safely and as easily as possible because our intent is not in getting to the top. If this station is ever set up, we want to get scientists into 18,000 feet with just as much of their physical power left as we possibly can so that they'll be able to really work up there and use their minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Washburn, can you think of anything you'd like to add to this interview that we haven't already covered?
Well, there's only one thing I would like to add in closing, and that is to say that it's very important to remember that we have carried out a reconnaissance. And that does not imply that we're going to build this station. I've been sent up here to investigate the possibilities of building it and to report back, as I've now done, to the Office of Naval Research and to the University of Chicago. And these reports will, of course, have to be coordinated with the Alaskan Air Command because it would be a very heavy air support project to drop all of this equipment. But if it's decided by the research people in Washington that it's a good plan to put in this station, as you know, it will be the highest research station of any sort in the world, and it would be a really fascinating and, I think, rather dramatic project to put through if it's done next year or the year after. That is now up to them to decide.
Your part of it is done, and the rest of it remains up to the powers that be. Well, thank you very much, Bradford Washburn, for appearing at the KFAR mic once again and answering what must seem to you to be a multitudinous array of questions. We deeply appreciate the time spent. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Bradford Washburn, the director of the Boston Museum of Science, who has been in Alaska for the past month under the auspices of the Boston Museum of Science, the Office of Naval Research, and the Alaskan Air Command. This is Don McCune speaking. This is the Midnight Sun Broadcasting Company.